Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello there, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, you can hear how the sack of Rome horrifies the civilized world in part 8 of our series by the title of The Vatican Centuries. And then you can join Dominican preacher and poet Paul Murray, who brings us a reflection on the mystery of hope, in which he speaks to us of French 20th century poet Charles Péguy. Thanks so much for joining me once again. I'd like to begin today by bringing you part 8 of our journey back in time to rediscover some of the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican throughout the centuries. A series written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Last week we heard how St. Peter's presented problems, how St. Ambrose defied the Emperor Theodosius, while all the while Christian Rome grew in importance. Today, in part 8 of this series, which Jill has entitled Sovereign Pontiff, we hear of the sack of Rome, lamented by Jerome, and how Leo the Great meets Attila the Hun.
The Roman Empire in the West was in its death throes. After the Emperor Theodosius died, the gap between East and West grew ever wider, and never again was there a single emperor reigning over the two parts of the empire.
For some time now, the barbarians had been on the move, and soon the hordes were sweeping across Europe. As the 5th century opened, they had penetrated the frontiers of the empire, and in no time at all were camped at the gates of Rome.
In 410 AD, the invincible city, racked by famine and disease, capitulated to Alaric the Goth.
The sack of Rome horrified the civilized world. But the Goths were not the monsters they have often been portrayed as. They were partially civilized and some were Christian. Alaric did not wish to destroy the Roman Empire. He admired it and wanted to become part of it.
But the Emperor Honorius refused any kind of integration, and so, after repeated rebuffs, Alaric took his revenge. His only concession was to give precise orders that no churches be touched, nor those who had taken refuge in them.
Not so squeamish were the invaders who came after him. Hot on the heels of the Goth came a far more savage and ruthless figure, Attila the Hun, whose legend went before him in the nickname he received, the Scourge of God. He crossed the Alps and quickly eliminated the northern Italian cities. Rome held its breath.
But Attila never came. He hadn't reckoned on another strong personality. In the summer of 452, a strange procession appeared on the banks of the river Mincio, where Attila was camped. Messengers from Rome, led by none other than Pope Leo I in person.
A 19th century historian, Gregor Ovius, recounts how this historic encounter took place.
The city saw with terror that it was being abandoned to the monstrous fury of that barbarian, and the Romans were desperate. The Senate decided to send a message to Attila, and for this they suggested the bishop Leo. Rarely has a churchman had a more glorious mission. The calm, venerable pontiff presenting himself to the most ferocious destroyer history has ever known, on the point of overthrowing the capital of civilization, is one of the greatest spectacles of history, one of the most sublime offices, and assures Leo of immortality, together with the gratitude of the entire human race.
No one knows exactly what the two men said to one another, but what is certain is that Attila turned back. Leo's action with Attila turned him into a hero with the Romans, who had watched helplessly while the emperor planned to flee the country. Moreover, on that occasion, the superiority of the spiritual power over the temporal was established once and for all.
Leo the Great, who reigned from 440 to 461, was in every sense a big man. Tuscan-born, he was Roman in spirit, with an inbred sense of authority. He was every inch a pope, and was the first pope to take over the old heathen title Pontifex Maximus, which the emperors had discarded. For years he fought for and won the supremacy of the Bishop of Rome over Christendom.
In 455, the Emperor Valentinian III supported Leo against Hilary of Arles, who had asserted the independence of the Church of Gaul. The Emperor declared that if any bishop summoned to trial before the Bishop of Rome should neglect to come, he must be compelled to attend. This decree traditionally marks the establishment of the Pope's primacy of jurisdiction and his unchallenged supremacy as Patriarch of the West.
It was Leo who first formulated the idea of the Pope as the representative of Peter, and he was the first to lay claim to the plenitude of power. Theologically, Leo's greatest achievement was his dogmatic letter, sent to St. Flavian in Constantinople. In it, he set out the true faith concerning the natures of Christ, and it was acclaimed as the teaching of the Church at the Council of Chalcedon in 451.
Solid, courageous, full of good sense and a faith which knew no doubts or hesitation, Leo was the best man for the job he did. A man of his time, but with a very strong sense of the timelessness of his mission. He raised the prestige of the Holy See to heights it had never known. And it was this, together with his defence of the faith against heresy, his intervention with Attila and later with Genseric the Vandal, which earned him the title of Great, a title to be shared by only two other popes. He died in 461 and was declared a Doctor of the Church in 1754.
A peculiarity of St. Peter's Basilica, and one which is still evident in today's church, is that it faces the east. All the churches built by Constantine the Great face the east, although some, like St. Paul's outside the walls, have been reoriented. St. Peter's has not. The rising sun, comments a modern writer, continues to shine upon the main entrance of St. Peter's as if it were a Greek temple to Apollo.
Leo the Great was most concerned about this problem of the rising sun. In 460 he wrote, "Having mounted the great flight of steps to the basilica, the Christians turn round and bend themselves to the rising sun, and with bowed heads incline their bodies in honour of the splendid orb. We greatly grieve at this, done partly through the vice of ignorance, partly in a spirit of paganism."
But Leo could have had little else to grumble about, for Rome, no longer the seat of the empire, had become the city of Peter and Paul, and Leo proclaimed it so in his sermons.
As more and more pilgrims converged on Christian Rome, other constructions were rising around St. Peter's to cater for their needs. Monasteries, pilgrims' hostels, baths and residences for groups of foreigners, which were later to become famous as the Scholae, of the Franks, the Saxons, the Frisians and other peoples. But before then, Rome was to suffer yet more tribulation. As, the empire gone, the abandoned city plunged into the abyss of the so-called Dark Ages.
When the aged St. Jerome in Bethlehem heard of the sack of Rome, he voiced his anguish in these words.
"The most brilliant light of all has gone out. The head of the world has been cut off. Over the ruins of a single city, the whole empire has gone to ruin. The city which was the capital of the world is the sepulchre of the Roman people. There is no country without its fugitives from Rome. Even as I dictate, my voice breaks in my throat, and sobs prevent me from speaking."
Contrasting with the sad accents of St. Jerome is this lyric by the 5th century pagan poet Rutilius Namatianus. Originally from Gaul, he had been governor of Tuscia and Umbria, and was returning home because of the growing invasions of Visigoths and Vandals. His farewell to the city which had given him hospitality and enriched his culture has been described as the last masterpiece in the classical Latin tongue. The Romans never read his poem, and today the name of Rutilius is known only to a handful of scholars.
"Listen, beautiful queen of a world which you made your own, O Rome, welcomed in the starry skies, listen, mother of men and of gods. Not so far from the sky are we when we are in your temples. You scatter your gifts equally wherever the sun shines, on whatever shore the waves of the ocean break. The burning sands of Libya did not stop you, nor did the furthest extremity of the earth with its weapons of ice make you turn back. You made a single fatherland for different peoples. It benefited him who was without laws to pay tribute to you, because you transformed men into citizens and made a city of that which before was only a globe.
You were listening there to part 8 of the Vatican Centuries, a series presented and written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Jean-Patrick Lovett. A big thank you to both of them. Finally, on a totally different note, we join Dominican preacher and poet Father Paul Murray of the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, who brings us a reflection on the mystery of hope, in which he speaks to us of French 20th century poet Charles Péguy.
What surprises me, says God, is hope. And I can't get over it, this little hope, who seems like nothing at all, this little girl, hope. Immortal. These astonishing lines are taken from a long prose poem on the theme of hope, composed by the French poet Charles Péguy in the early years of the 20th century. No author in modern times, I would say, has surpassed Péguy as the poet of the mystery of hope. According to Hans Urs von Balthasar, Péguy was given the privilege of uttering words beyond all the fluency of theology to date. He possessed, in the opinion of Balthasar, the gift of being able to penetrate more deeply than any other Christian poet into the secrets of the tenderness of God's heart. Péguy, we discover, does not simply meditate in his work on the great dogmatic truths and mysteries of the faith. He does that, of course, and with a consistency and passion almost unique in modern times. But he does something else as well, something quite astonishing. He speaks, he dares to speak, as if he were a prophet of the New Testament. In line after line of plain but rhythmic prose, Péguy allows us to hear God the Father, the living God, revealed to us by the Son, speaking in his own voice, as it were, speaking, that is, through his poet-prophet Péguy, and speaking out plainly and directly. In one particularly striking passage, which is directly concerned with the theme of hope, we hear God the Father expressing his utter amazement at the fact that human beings, in spite of the trials and disappointments of life, and in spite of the consequent temptations to despair, are still somehow capable of hope. The passage in question is from Peggy's long prose poem, The Portal of the Mystery of Hope. Charity, says God. That doesn't surprise me. It's not surprising. How could human beings not love their brothers? How could they not take the bread from their own mouth, their daily bread, in order to give it to the needy and to the unhappy children? But hope, says God, that is something that surprises me. Even me, that is surprising. That these poor creatures, although well aware of how things are going, can still believe that tomorrow things will go better, that is surprising. And it's by far the greatest marvel of our grace. And I'm surprised by it myself. And my grace must indeed be an incredible force, and must flow freely and like an inexhaustible river ever since the first time it flowed, that time that it flowed like a river of blood from the pierced side of my son. What must my grace and the strength of my grace be that this little hope, vacillating at the breath of sin, trembling with every word, anxious at the slightest breath, be as constant, remain as faithful, as righteous, as pure, and invincible, and immortal, and impossible to extinguish as that little flame in the sanctuary? What surprises me, says God, is hope. And I can't get over it. This little hope, who seems like nothing at all, this little girl, hope, immortal. At a first reading, one might imagine that the emphasis on childlike simplicity and trust in Peggy's work springs from a wholly serene and uncomplicated mind and heart. But the Frenchman's devotional and theological vision, his profound faith awareness, was from the beginning tested and purified in the crucible of certain very painful and unusual circumstances. Peggy was, we can say, a dogmatic poet in an age of unbelief, and yet, not far beneath the surface of his best work, we can hear again and again the cadence of an intensely personal, questioning voice. In his long prose poem, for example, The Portal of the Mystery of Hope, a number of statements voiced for God the Father are statements which, at one level at least, Peggy, it would seem, is addressing to his own heart and addressing, perhaps, at a time of almost unbearable anguish. In one place, he writes, "Put off until tomorrow those concerns and those worries that are eating at you today and that might devour you today. Put off until tomorrow those sobs that choke you when you see today's misery, those sobs which rise in you and strangle you. Put off until tomorrow those tears that fill your eyes and cover your face, that flood you, that fall down your cheeks." Enormous suffering marked the short life of Charles Peggy. But when we open his collected poems and begin to read the work, the realm we enter into is, to our great surprise, not so much a kingdom of sorrow, but rather a domain of joy and a domain of hope. The sorrow is there, of course, an anguish often evident between the lines, and even on occasion in the lines themselves. Nevertheless, far from being maudlin in any way, Peggy's verse is distinguished throughout by a hard, flame-like spirit and by a virile joy. According to Henri Bergson, the celebrated philosopher and a close acquaintance of the poet, Peggy possessed the marvelous gift of somehow penetrating to the very core of a person's mind. Bergson remarked, "He knew my most secret thought, such as I had never expressed it." I think something of that penetrating gaze still survives today in Peggy's prose and poetry. One may well decide at a certain moment, as in a talk such as this, for example, to take up Peggy's verse and scrutinize it at some length. But soon one begins to realize, and even in the act of scrutiny itself, that while we, as readers or as listeners, are casting a critical eye at the work and a critical eye at the man, Peggy himself, the stubborn celebrant of hope, the defeated, undefeated guardian and prophet of the inner life, the man of enormous sorrow and of enormous joy, is scrutinizing us and piercing us with his gaze. Peggy's vision of hope is without question distinctly childlike, but it is never sentimental. In his prose poem, The Portal of the Mystery of Hope, hope, the virtue of hope, is understood as a force which rises like new blood or like sap in the month of May. Grace that somehow breaks through what he calls the thick skin of our hearts, through the skin of anger, through the skin of despair, through the thick skin of sin. In The Portal, Peggy speaks of carnal pride, our human pride, and distinguishes it from the pride of the fallen angels. Their pride, he insists, was a poor pride of ideas, a pale pride, a vain pride, all in the head. Human pride, in contrast, is a thick and heavy pride, nourished by fat and blood, brimming with health, the skin glowing. Pride of the blood, pride of the flesh, which swells and buzzes throughout the body like a buzzing storm, and which throbs at the temples like the beating of a drum. This pride of the flesh was not redeemed by spirit alone, but by incarnation, by the flesh and blood of Christ. And the parables of Christ form part of the grace of that redemption. They, the parables, speak directly and powerfully to the heart of the weakest sinner. Of all the parables of Christ, the parable of greatest hope, in Peggy's opinion, is the parable of the prodigal son. Peggy writes, "This one has awakened the deepest echo, the most ancient echo, the only one that the sinner has never been able to silence in his heart. The word of hope, then, is the one word that the sinner, even as he turns away from God and buries himself in lost countries, and tries to put everything that is sacred out of his mind, will never be able to forget. Again, Peggy writes, "Once this word of hope has bitten into his heart, into his believing or unbelieving heart, no pleasure will evermore be able to erase its teeth marks. Such is this word. She's a word that stays with you. She follows like a dog that remains, even though you beat it." The image is as unexpected as the reality it describes. Hope for Peggy is a mystery of God's love. It is the signature of God's purpose, the grace and surprise of a loving, relentless pursuit, the one pressure of grace that the sinner will never finally be able to elude or escape. In order now to bring this brief reflection to a close, I would like to read another few lines from Peggy, lines which take up once again the theme of the mystery of hope, and which in passing refer to what Peggy calls irrevocable words. These words are, it hardly needs to be said, the words of revelation, the astonishing words of love and of trust, which, even for the least of us, have opened up a door, an entry into a wholly new world. Peggy writes, "Remarkable overturning that runs through all the mysteries and makes them grow, increases them to infinity. You must have confidence in God. God put his hope in us. He took the initiative. He hoped that the least of the sinners, the very least, would work a little for his own salvation. He hoped in us. Will it be said that we didn't hope in him? God placed his hope, his poor hope, in each one of us. Abyss of hope. What an opening, what lightning, what thunder, what a passageway, what an entrance. Irrevocable words. What an entry into the very hope of God."
And warm thanks there to our Dominican preacher and poet, Father Paul Murray of the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, for this beautiful reflection on the mystery of hope. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. And should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. And don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.